Hey, Steve Smith.
Brett Starr.
How you doing today, man?
Doing great. How are you?
Good. I mean, it's. I said last week it was tilting towards autumn.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so today. It's a nice, cool day. Weather's fantastic. I had a nice lunch at Hop Dotty Burgers.
Oh.
Down the street.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Like that place.
Can't complain. What'd you have for lunch?
I had a frozen lunch thing. You know, I did my, you know, usual midweek kind of like 3.5 minute lunch. So,
nice.
You know, gotta stay honest. You know, gotta
sounds like
nose to the grindstone.
We're creating a great work environment for ourselves.
Well, I did take the dog on a 45 minute walk. So there was that. I got a little nature, a little animal time.
Glad to hear it. Well, we are here today to talk once again about Work Tech Weekly. Your industry newsletter for work tech that you put out every week. And I guess the big news today, I mean, I think you're probably the only person who calls the quarter, and you've been doing it for 10 years in terms of how much investment is flowing into work tech every quarter. And you're releasing it every week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this company got $17 billion. This one got a septillion amount of dollars, et cetera. But what I really like is that you also come back and say, okay, here was the quarter. Here's the year. Here's what this looks like over literally, I think, the past 20 years that we've been tracking it. So what's the big news about work tech investment this quarter?
Well, for Q3, work tech investment cracked $20 billion. And for context, 2020 ended up, I think, at $9.3 billion.
The whole year. And this is one quarter of $20 billion.
Yeah. So that's, I think, interesting. And then, you know, just in the first 2 weeks of this quarter, we've already seen $2 billion more dollars. So, you know, I think it's not outside the realm of possibility that, you know, investment levels hits $30 billion for the year, which is just staggering. And I think the other thing that's noteworthy is it's the fifth consecutive record quarter. And we've seen like $100+ million deals double this year. I think there were 35 last year, and we've already seen 69 or 70 this year, including like 7 in the last week. So more bigger deals, and those seem to be accelerating. One of the things I'm kind of curious about is there's a lot of like, if you read a lot of boring tax policy and economic policy emails, there's a lot of talk in Washington about maybe changing the holding period around investments from 3 years to 5 years. And I think that that's creating some momentum in terms of investors wanting to put money into companies before the end of the calendar year. Also, I think that there's just a lot of money sloshing around. It's got to go somewhere. So,
well, let's put all that in perspective because I don't have the best memory and I tend to exaggerate, but I believe that in the year 2000, remember Conan O'Brien in the year 2000,
or the Flight of the Conchords,
that's right.
the year 2000. Yeah.
I believe that in the year 2000, there was like a $200 million investment in work tech for the year. And we were like, oh, I think this might be a market that we should focus on.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's funny is I remember when I came into the agency and I was telling one of my friends, yeah, I'm going to this marketing agency that focuses on HR technology. And she put her hand on my shoulder and says, Steve, you're going to starve to death. There's not enough business going on. And the funny thing is now she actually runs a workplace technology company. So, you know, everything's come full circle.
Well, there you go. I mean, there's so many things to, you know, kind of unpack, but we are in a parabolic hockey stick. We are in what the crypto kids call to the moon phase. You know, things are going crazy.
Yep.
And when things like this happen, because it's just been year after, I don't think we've had a year since 2000. Again, correct me if I'm wrong, Since the year 2000, I don't think we've had a single year where the investment in work tech has been lower than the previous year. Is that correct?
That actually is not correct.
Thank you.
It was, we saw it go up in 14, I think it was 14, 15, and I think 16 came down a little bit. But since then, since 2017, it's just been practically doubling year over year.
Okay. Well, I'm going to edit that out because, you know, my brand is always being right. Yeah. So we're just going to.
No, you're right, Brett. That you're absolutely
thank you.
Right.
No, but mostly, I mean, if you did like a 3-year moving average, it's been going up the whole time. And when stuff like this happens, like the levels of investment that we're in, and, you know, everyone tends to, you know, kind of make that logical fallacy of overgeneralization and tie like what's going on in work tech to the broader markets or whatever. And they say, well, the market's going to do this or the market's going to do that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, year after year after year, people have said there's a bubble here, there's a bubble over there. And a lot of people want to translate that notion of the bubble mm-hmm. in some general market context of what's going on in work tech. And I think what a lot of people are feeling right now without probably knowing how big the numbers are this quarter or this year is that we're kind of at a peak oil moment in work tech. Do you believe that's true?
Define peak oil moment in work tech.
Well, you know, peak oil, have you ever heard the phrase peak
yeah.
oil? You know, that whole notion that's like we're producing as much oil as will ever be produced and it's all downhill mm-hmm. from here.
Which didn't turn out to be like, true.
No, yeah, exactly. And it's only true if you believe it and, you know, start acting like it's true, right?
Right?
We're at a moment where people feel like it's getting so frothy to the point that this is the moment where everyone, you know, catches sanity. And every year after this is going to be smaller. There's going to be less investment. There's going to be less innovation. There's going to be less, you know, whatever. But, you know, something when the numbers get this big, when the deals get this big, when the mergers get this big, when the acquisitions get this big, yeah. when the funding rounds get this big, that something's got to give, right? Do you believe that's true?
Well, I mean, I do feel like the market is way overpriced. And, you know, the business cycle didn't suddenly go away. It's not like, you know, things only go up. When you get into that sort of thinking, that's very kind of like 1999, the business cycle is mm-hmm. dead. Let's get the who to come play our company party and, you know, invest a lot of money in a sock puppet, you know, so.
Thomas Middleditch.
Yeah. I don't know that we're at that point yet, but, you know, at some point, you know, you can't see these numbers just keep going up and up. There will have to be some level of reset that comes into the market. But the fact is that we are in the middle of an unprecedented change in the way that people work. Companies have lots of technology needs that are unmet, and companies are going to continue buying. Employers are going to continue investing in technology solutions.
Yeah, and I kind of disagree, but only on a technicality.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not going to go hard this time, but also before I go there, I just want to point out I'm drinking Lone Star.
National today. Beer of Texas.
Yes, the National Beer of Texas. One of the greatest slogans ever invented, the National Beer of Texas.
Have you ever been to the Continental Club and heard Dale Watson on a Monday night? Where
I played at the Continental
okay.
Club with
Here
Junior
come
Brown.
The
with Junior Brown.
Ooh, Junior Brown. There's a blast
Man,
in the
with
past.
With his Get Steel.
Yeah,
I mean, anybody out there who's never heard Junior Brown,
just turn this podcast off right now. Google
right
Junior
now.
Brown. Listen to that for about an hour.
He is the Jimi Hendrix of rockabilly of old. I mean, just what a genius. But yes, but please go on. It's not all about me.
No, but he would do that Lone Star commercial, like, you know, right in the middle of the set. He does a really great Lone Star commercial.
Yeah, that's right.
And then someone inevitably buys him a Lone Star and a shot of tequila. And after about 5 Lone Star commercials, he's pretty crocked, but he still can play.
Well, that's Dale Watson,
yeah.
right? And so that's at the Continental Club. But did you ever see him at Jenny's Little Longhorn?
No. Was that where they have okay. Chicken Chip Bingo?
Chicken Chip Bingo. That's what I was going to bring up. Yeah, so he played down on Burnett Road in Austin, Texas.
That's old school Austin country.
Old school. And so for anyone who doesn't know Chicken Shit Bingo, count yourself lucky because you're probably a redneck from,
yeah.
you know, like Rockabilly
You've made some
Land,
good choices
Texas.
In your life if you haven't heard of Chicken Shit Bingo.
But Dale Watson, who is just a legend and just, I mean, this is a guy who could play for 8 hours and, you know, any song that you wanted to hear, he knew it. He could bring, you know, 15 hours of his own music. and just a, you know, just an incredible, you know, probably the hardest working person in like rockabilly. Mm-hmm. When he played at Jenny's Little Longhorn, he'd play these famous 2-hour sets that went on for like 6 or 7 hours, and they'd call a halftime in the middle, and everybody would buy lottery tickets for chicken shit bingo. And what would happen is they would bring out this chicken and put the chicken in a cage. This sounds crazy.
And it did not violate any health codes at all.
No. And the floor of the cage had a bunch of different numbers on it. And wherever the chicken shat, whoever was holding that ticket won, probably like a Lone Star. But, I mean, like, it was peak oil for rockabilly culture in Austin, Texas.
Wow, that was shit. A hard left of a tangent we just took.
Man, what were we talking about?
I don't even remember.
Oh, yeah, how I disagree with you. So this is why I disagree with you. I think that the numbers are going to go up for a long time for two reasons. Number one is that I believe truly that we are at the front edge of the greatest moment of technology switching in history, bigger even than when people were switching from on-premise solutions to cloud solutions, because of people's recognition of the role of decentralization and employee experience in the way that we're working now, caused by the event of the pandemic, but also what we learned about how people work in the pandemic. So I think that we are in a cycle where the investment may, in like startups and everything kind of quail. Mm-hmm. But the money that's being earned by companies who are selling innovative solutions that represent a new way to work is going to, that's got like a 5 to 10 year, kind of ramp.
Yeah.
But the other thing is work tech is becoming everything. And so even in the numbers, and tell me if I'm wrong, but even the numbers that you track, work tech before becoming work tech was HR tech, right? And HR tech had a very narrow scope in terms of what gets counted in those numbers. Yeah. But now you've got companies who are coming into work tech that get counted, and they're not what we would have considered, kind of pure category companies back in the day. But not only that, it was a necessary shift because the definition of work tech is broadening all the time. Right. And I think that definition is going to continue to broaden. Mm-hmm. So even if like the average deal size goes down, even if the average investment goes down, even if like whatever, the things that will be classified as investments in companies who are changing, the relationship between the employee experience, the customer experience, and the shareholder experience is going to broaden. And so I think there's still a lot of runway. Thoughts?
But I think also like what is going to be the growth areas in work tech are going to be dramatically different over the next 10 years than the past 10 years. When you look at everything that's going on in the labor market and just labor shortages everywhere, number one, I think that it's going to accelerate moves toward AI and toward automation. Mm-hmm. So in 10 years, like right now that we've got this backlog of goods that, not only can they not get unloaded from container ships in Los Angeles, there's 22,000 fewer truck drivers now than there were in 2019.
Well, all because of paternity leave.
Yeah, it's paternity leave's fault. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. No, but the thing is like, how long will it take for that solution to be automated? When you think about what if, self-driving trucks that you don't have to worry about paying a driver 6 figures a year, are they hopped up on speed and have they gotten enough sleep in the last week? All that shit. And so it's just like you have that, you have the automation of like checkout in the grocery store, displacing retail associates, displacing warehouse workers. I think that when you just kind of look at the potential for automation and AI to, displace millions and millions of workers, and then what the socioeconomic impact of that is going to be.
Well, we were texting about this earlier today about, how the pivot point of technology has changed so rapidly. And now it's all about flow of work and AI and NLP and all that stuff. And it's really interesting because to your point, probably 6 or 7 years ago, if you went to like HR tech or some like industry show or whatever, all these people would have these, you know, booths and everything, and their primary message would be artificial intelligence, as if that's what they were selling. But it was like a technology in search of a solution, right? Like they couldn't really do a good job of like placing it in the context of what like problems it solved. And unfortunately, in my opinion, artificial intelligence was first applied to talent acquisition in a really significant way and to, you know, dubious results, in my opinion. I mean, I think artificial intelligence often had the impact of reinforcing bias while it took away the bias, if that makes sense. And so I think that now, you know, for a while there, people cooled on the notion of like why AI is important in work tech. But now it's like, if you are a strategic buyer, if you are a, you know, like a company who's looking to build the next solution, if it's not, if it doesn't have AI, if it's not in the flow of work, then it's like old school. Because a lot of the technologies out there today, like just taking, employee listening, for instance, one of my favorite categories, and, you know, really, I don't think you can have an employee experience, solution without having some form of employee listening. But if it's purely survey driven, I think that those days are quickly coming to an end.
Completely agree.
Really good solution. Like Joyous and, you know, all these great solutions that really make, effective use of AI. Like those are table stakes now. Did that surprise you how rapidly that transformation happened?
Yeah, I mean, it went from, you know, surveys were, you know, you go back to 15 and 16, completely blowing up, and you have, you know, these giant exits like Glint and Peakon. But if you kind of look at where the functionality is now, it seems like a lot of the gold is really in sentiment analysis that's going on in the back end. And it's not just from surveys, because I believe employees who've got survey fatigue from getting pinged eight times about, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And they're like, I don't have time for this. I actually want to do some work and you're annoying me anyway, so leave me alone. But, you know, you don't need to, you know, interrupt the employee. You can get all that data. You know, is all of that stuff white hat? You know, we'll see. There's a kind of a dark underbelly to that potentially, if it's not, you know, it doesn't unfold in the right way. But yeah, I mean, it's funny how that entire category has completely shifted in such a short time horizon.
Well, you said so many things that, you know, I want to drill down on in that one statement, but, you know, let's kind of unpack it piece by piece. First of all, yeah, survey fatigue is a real thing. Even our little, you know, 100-person shop, which I've been corrected about that, but, you know, 100-person shop, I am starting to feel like our employee net promoter score program, which is like one of the roots of how we ensure a good employee experience, is to one of the second points that you made, creating interruptions. So it's more time that people have to take out of their day to answer the, because we send it out every week and we close the loop within 24 hours. And that throws off a lot of meta work, you know, that's super important to the employee experience, but also interrupts people, which can have a significant impact on their ability to get into a deep work state and stuff like that. And so I totally agree that survey fatigue is becoming a super real thing, but I think it's tied to a bigger picture of just the enormous number of interruptions that are entering people's, you know, work lives and personal lives that prevent them from being able to achieve a deep state work, which results in high quality work, which results in fast work, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, I'm sure that the notion of achieving the ability to process feedback and derive issues and opportunities and then create solutions for that seems daunting if you're not doing surveys. And I don't think surveys are dead by
any
stretch
of
the imagination, but there definitely are too many of them. And I think we're probably in about a 5-year transformation where sentiment analysis is going to become, the technology that drives sentiment analysis is going to become commoditized. And then it's the like application of that technology that is going to make the biggest difference.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think another thing that I'm really interested to see how it plays out, because I think it could be completely disruptive for the industry, is low code, no code solutions.
I knew you were going to talk about low code, no
Boom,
code.
Boom, that just happened. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many, you know, companies out there that are just, you know, swimming in investment cash. And we think about for many enterprises, it's just like that off the shelf, you know, SaaS solution just won't get it done. You need it to do this, this, and this. And it's just like, if you can basically just build what you need rather than have to figure out how to take someone else's solution and hold, please.
Somebody wanting to spend money.
I know. No,
I don't mean with us. They probably want to put $200 million into, you know, some continuous performance management company or something.
Yeah. But, you know, so it's just like, how disruptive is that going to be to some of the major players in the industry? You know, is it going to be in 5 years or waking up and be like, hey, you know what? I don't need, you know, all this, you know, BS from, you know, insert name of major brand here. Oh, yeah, we're just going to build our own.
Give me an example of a use case for low code, no code, and an example of a company in WorkTech who's doing it well.
Boy, you would put me on the spot like that.
Well, we can always edit it out if you can't come up with it.
Well, you know, I think that, you know, I don't think anybody in WorkTech is doing it particularly well. I think you're seeing a lot of these, you know, new brands begin to emerge, you know, the Airtables and the UiPaths that are, you know, coming onto the scene, and then a whole, you know, raft of other brands that are accumulating capital at a furious rate. But I don't think anyone is doing it particularly well, much like, you know, when you look at like AI solutions and automation, it's all still nascent. And I think it's going to go from, you know, wow, this sounds good, but it's too much of a pain in the ass to do anything with, to, no, this is actually a better way to do things.
Yeah, but why do I need it? Why do I need it? So I'm an administrator of a well-being program inside my company. Why do I need
it? Well, I mean, let's start with probably the easiest use case is like when you get into talent acquisition, where it's just like there are so many hoops within any talent acquisition process that not every company needs necessarily to kind of jump through all of those, especially if you have internal recruiters and you have processes that have served you well. Why is it that you necessarily have to, you know, go with a third party? Because a lot of times the solutions end up, you know, like a lot of big solutions, being overbuilt. And I think that's true for a lot of workplace technology. It's just like, you know, you have to continually have a quarterly release. And so you keep adding bells and whistles, you know, and you end up with kind of this bloated software that has to be that way because they always have to have something to promote rather than this is just what we need to get whatever job done.
Yeah, I know something, you know, because I have a very rudimentary perspective on life, generally speaking. So things catch my attention.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, I do. When they're on TV. Have you noticed all the Smartsheet commercials that have been on television lately?
No, I actually have not.
Are you not watching baseball?
I've been watching baseball, but I sort of tuned out when the Giants lost.
I'm so sorry, man. Well, now it's like the Red Sox versus the Astros, two of my favorite teams in the world, playing each other in the American League Championship Series. So I'm totally tuned in. But Smartsheet is, you know, kind of a version of what low code, no code is supposed to mean. It's like, hey, here's this horizontal solution that you can do anything with, fit it to your business processes and make it work for you. And when that stuff starts showing up in television commercials, and we all know how that media gets bought, it's regional, it's focused on, you know, like whatever. It doesn't mean that it's like in the old days, you run a commercial on NBC and that means that you have to spend $15 million, you know, to get it run. But, you know, it reminds me of, you know, back when before UKG was UKG, when Ultimate Software, and we kind of had some insight into this, started, you know, doing sponsorships and celebrity endorsements. Right. And, you know, they were in, you know, every stadium, you know, or and now, you know, UKG is synonymous with like the US Open and golf and stuff like that. It means something because it means that the media field has become so crowded at the industry level, at the pay-per-click level, at the digital level, that while at the same time, the value proposition is so expansive that you have to reach a broader audience. And so when I saw these Smartsheet, you know, like commercials on television, I'm like, really? Because that used to be like this, you know, like almost like a productivity app, but it's being positioned as kind of like almost a platform as a service or whatever. But that brings me back to a point around the flood of money going into work tech, because my perspective is always that when you see these multiple billions of dollars, you know, a quarter going into work tech, I'm always like, well, 10% of that's going straight into media buys.
Yeah.
You know, and not because I'm a greedy bastard, but because it to me is a harbinger of the shifting conditions in marketing for work tech companies, where the notion of an inbound model where you have localized, centralized content on your website and you expect a bunch of people to come to your website and drive a bunch of leads from people with purchase intent and, you know, convert them to SQLs and drive them through the funnel and all that stuff. You just can't compete anymore.
Right.
Because somebody's just going to come and put, you know, a $15 million a month bet, literally a $15 million a month bet on owning, you know, search phrases and stuff like that. So it's completely shifted the dynamic of marketing for work tech companies.
Yeah. Oh, no, I totally agree. And when you look at, you know, we can go back through kind of historic data we have about conversion rates, and you've seen inbound marketing just declining since 2012, really. And I think that over the last 18 months, that's really accelerated. Just because there's so much cash out there that, I mean, within kind of like work tech industry channels, inventory is just getting snapped up. If you look at the, you know, work tech analyst ecosystem, all of their inventory is getting snapped up. Then, you know, keywords, you try to buy keywords for like continuous performance management. Good luck on that, because it's just like you're going to be, it's all stratospheric. Then you're getting into the review sites, the G2s and the Capteras. All that's getting really, really super expensive. And then the next frontier is like intent data. So it's not surprising that you're seeing, you know, more, I think, branding investments where, you know, you crack open the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, you're seeing like full page work tech ads, either, you know, from Google, or Autodesk had one the other day in the Times, you know, it's like full page newspaper advertisements. That's pretty old school. But then, you know, you turn on the TV, and to your point, it's just like, you know, UKG is out there, Paycom, a lot of the big HCM brands are investing heavily in brand. Or you turn on satellite radio and, you know, you get hit with a payroll company just about every commercial break if you're listening to a news or sports channel. It's really fascinating.
Well, it really is. It reminds me of the days when I lived in Boston, like way back in the days. And the reason I'm such a Red Sox fan is because Jennifer and I lived like three blocks down from Fenway Park. And we would, I actually worked for this person named Nicole Stata at a company called Deploy Solutions. And she had tickets behind home plate for the Red Sox. And she never went. So she would always give me the tickets because I was the latest guy in the office. Right. And so I'd be like coming home and I'd say, hey, Jennifer, you want to go to the game? It's like, yeah. So we probably saw, no exaggeration, 20 or 30 games a year. Just loved it. And what was my point about? Oh, yeah. So when I was living in Boston at that time, which was like, let's say 2001, 2002, 2003, like a 5-year period, I remember the first time I was driving home from one of those outlying areas in Boston, because we lived in the South End on Tremont and West Concord. And I heard a Constant Contact commercial on the radio. And I was like, why am I hearing a Constant Contact commercial on the radio? It's like they're, you know, advertising to me.
You are a demographic, Brett.
I know. And I was like, holy cow, you know, this whole marketing automation thing is going to become something, you know, it's like, and suddenly I feel important, which I don't think should be discounted in the role of like what advertising achieves or what branding achieves. It's like if you, I can't, Jennifer's getting sick of it. Like when we're watching the US Open or something like that, I'm like, client.
I do the same
client.
Thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're a client.
But it makes me,
they're a client.
Yeah, it makes me feel good. And I can't imagine that there's not hundreds of thousands of people, you know, or more around the country and around the world who are also saying, oh, that's the solution that I bought, or that's the solution that we use, or, you know, like whatever. And so it has this, you know, kind of reinforcing impact on the customer experience, which, you know, I think a lot of people in B2B have always discounted. And so I think the big picture there is that this notion that you're going to pin your entire marketing strategy on someone finding your thought leadership article by clicking on a Google ad is just not it. You just can't do that anymore. It's like the whole idea of centralized content production that gets executed by a small group of people inside a company and the slow cycles that it takes to produce that content and the number of people that have to redline it. And then it gets attached to an email or gets put in a pay-per-click, thread or something like that. That can't work anymore, especially for the bigger brands. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're seeing a complete sea change in how people should be spending their money, spending their time, and promoting themselves to folks out there in the world.
Yeah, we can see it unfolding in real time because it's just like everybody's got the same pain points. It's the stuff that used to work. Or it doesn't work anymore, or they've depended on inbound, and they haven't bothered to invest in outbound capabilities. I was talking to a client today who's going to a new opportunity, as they say, and she was talking about, hey, there's this really great company. They're seeing this. Really great year-over-year growth. They're a big company. They're seeing 35-40% year-over-year growth and not doing any outbound at all. It's just all kind of inbound. I was like, wow, if you actually institute some like best practices around ABM, around building out that outbound strategy, you can probably double that pretty easily. She's like, yeah, I know. That's what I'm going to do.
Well, and that's the thing that everybody gets wrong about account-based marketing in B2B, but especially from our perspective we mostly see work tech companies, is account-based marketing. When people start flipping all those switches that you were talking about around purchase intent and stuff like that, and suddenly their account-based marketing list grows from, 500 to 50,000, they're not running an account-based marketing program anymore. They're running a very expensive inbound program because they're still trying to find people who have purchase intent. And what's missing is, this kind of engage motion between the like, hey, connect and convert. Right. And that's what everybody wants to do. They want to connect and convert. But all the value is in the 3 or 4 or 5 years that it actually takes to engage someone so that you're the early favorite vendor when they either develop purchase intent or, in the best case scenario, when you cause them to develop purchase intent. And there's no resources for it. Last thing I'll say, sorry, is everybody wants their salespeople, their SDRs, to be the folks who do all these, like, these engagement building activities, sequences, templates, cadences, et cetera. All of those folks get comped on setting meetings. And so if you ask them just to do a nice thing and deliver, a great customer experience in the engage motion, it's behavioral economics. They're sitting down and they're like, well, I get paid to set a meeting. All these leads that are coming from account-based marketing suck, because they're not ready to set a meeting. So I'm going to spend all my time over here, and they're completely missing the point, in my opinion.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think, this is something that, you have really kind of hammered over the years. And it really is true about what makes a qualified buyer. It's not an intrinsic quality. It's an extrinsic quality. And we've seen it play out time and time again where, hey, I don't really have time to talk to you. And 30 minutes later, I'm very interested in working with you. And it's all about how do you manage that conversation? Or just like, here's an RFP. You're not our early favorite vendor. Yeah, we don't do RFPs. What? Let's have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And then they throw out the RFP and we end up working with them. And so it's just like, I've seen a lot of sales teams throughout the space employ those same kind of motions successfully. And it's because they realize it's just like, it's not about, here are the leads, your leads suck. It's just like, what do you do with those leads?
Yeah, and also sometimes they're not leads, and that's like, we want to put this label on it, like, okay, like you take a content syndication lead driven from account-based marketing. The only thing a content syndication lead does is imply that the person who downloaded the content is interested in your category. Right. Or it doesn't mean, they probably don't even remember where they downloaded the damn white paper and or who the brand was that published the white, and they don't. But that's the connect motion And then you spend the next 2-3 years engaging them. And then at some point you convert them. But, you know, this is such a, you know, fast food culture in sales and marketing that it's like, if somebody downloads our white paper, even if it's on, you know, a content syndicated website, I want to call them and I want them to know who we are and I want budget, authority, time frame, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, that's not marketing, you know, that's not how it
works. But then the other thing is just like, you know, when, you know, a sales rep gets, you know, an inbound inquiry, it's just like, hey, let's nurture this thing for a couple of months. I'm not even going to reach out. Instead of just picking up the damn phone and saying, hey, just saw you downloaded a white paper, want to make sure you got everything okay. You know, because a lot of times it's just like, there's a sales opportunity right there if you'll just pick up the damn phone and call them right in that moment.
It's a great point. It's a great point because sales isn't doing anything wrong in terms of wanting to consume the raw material of sales qualified leads. Marketing isn't doing anything wrong in terms of connecting with people who could be customers in the future. But there's this whole middle ground of like missing effort, resource, et cetera, that's just about building engagement with people over time. And, you know, the other just kind of, you know, finer point that I would make on that is like, when you say pick up the phone, you're not speaking metaphorically.
No.
You're like, pick up the phone. And when I say that, everybody's like, you're old. That's not how it works anymore. Everybody's at home, so you can't get them on the phone anyway, et cetera, et cetera. And I think all that's bullshit.
Yeah, it is.
Because the prospect sourcing software that we have access to, and if we have access to it, you know, other people can. Gives you mobile numbers, gives you direct lines. And anybody who still has an office line out there, it's not a phantom line. They're calling in to check the voicemail. And a voicemail is a very powerful, you know, customer experience moment if you use it the right way and you're not just like, hey, you want to buy some stuff. I used to work with this guy named Leith Anderson at this old company called Partnerware in Austin, Texas. He was friends with William Shatner, and he let everybody know like every day. And Leith Anderson had a voice like this. He'd always talk like this. And he came into this company that had like $110 million of funding during the internet bubble in Austin, Texas. That was a lot of money.
It was a lot of money back then.
Funny to say that, isn't it? That was a lot of money back then, $110 million. And Leith Anderson was the guy who was sent in to fix sales and marketing. And most of the time he was calling in from a golf course or something like that, you know, like California or whatever. But he was like, hey. So this category was called partner relationship management. The whole thing was built on Dreamweaver. So like the first client was Charles Schwab, and it could scale like 5 users and had to like support like 150,000.
Did it have Goldmine written into it also?
It did. It was like, it was integrated with like
and vignettes.
And Goldmine. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which vignettes also an awesome company.
They were.
Isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I remember, that's a different story, but, office manager at Vignette made like millions in stock. You know, that's the bubble. But anyway, Leith Anderson was like, our sales and marketing strategy can't be like picking up the phone and saying, hey, you want to buy some PRM? You know, it's like, but even intuitively he got it back then. You know, you don't just like try to convert someone into a sale immediately without establishing a relationship or, you know, a deeper level of comprehension or whatever.
Yeah, but it's just like that's still, you know, what we see a lot of, you know, and nothing is more infuriating than it's just like you're talking to a marketing lead and they're saying, hey, you know, we're hitting our MQL goals, we're, you know, we're getting the volume of traffic, and it's just like you start looking at, okay, so what's the quality like? What, you know, have you followed up on this channel? And it's just like, no, they haven't followed up on anything. Everything went straight into nurture. And it's just like, you know, rip the damn headphones off, throw them out the window. It's just like, why? A sales rep can only play so much fantasy baseball before they just have some time to pick up the phone.
Well, now that's just a shitty thing to say, Steve.
This is why our sales team loves me.
I mean, I think the reality is that this tension that exists between sales and marketing is caused, honestly, by they're all doing the right thing, but there's this thing that's not being done that's missing. And it's just, I think it's going to take a while for people to recognize that, you know, there's the need, in my opinion, for a whole new department, for a whole, and that, shit, I can't believe I just said that. I don't mean department like in a hierarchical sense. I mean, there's a body of work that people need to flow to that doesn't have anything to do with the work that we're doing now. And it's like a customer service moment between marketing and sales where you're just taking care of people and providing value. You know what I mean? And that's not in, and dare I say it, it goes hand in hand with the value destruction that we see with, you know, rapid investment cycles and, you know, companies are supposed to go from 0 to 1,000 employees in, you know, 2 years. People don't have time to do it the right way, you know? And I think that that, unfortunately, you know, for the rest of the world out there of companies who didn't just get $100 million round and they're trying to grow 10, 15, 20% a year, which is a nice growth rate, feel like everything's moving so slow and they're supposed to follow the same motions that these other companies who are spending $50 million a year in marketing or whatever are, you know, going through. And it's just not right for them. It's, and I think there's a lot of value destruction that happens there. I don't think it serves the market well sometimes.
Totally agree with you, Red Star. Totally agree.
Well, I agree with you for agreeing with me.
7 minute lull.
Yeah. Well, the, I think the big picture here, to, try to draw some conclusion around this, wide ranging and unstructured conversation is that a lot of money is being spent and invested, in work tech. And that's changing things in ways that, a lot of people just aren't tuned into. And the repercussions of that are significant. And I think sometimes people just ought to ask themselves the question, if we knew that $10 billion a year was being spent in sales and marketing, just in my little category, my little niche category of the bigger category of the platform of the whatever, like how would that cause them to reevaluate the way that they're doing things? Because most people are just following a playbook. Mm-hmm. And the playbook is mostly based on the positions that they think they need to hire instead of the work that probably ought to be done. You know what I mean? It's like, we need SDRs. We need, you know, a content person. We need A, B, C, D, and E. But that's organizing around titles and org charts and stuff like that instead of organizing around the work that needs to be done. And I think the work that needs to be done is different now than it was five years ago. Because of the amount of money that is in the space, and that the models for you know, people being able to do that work have also changed.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, and I think that there's a widespread misunderstanding with just how much things have changed from a sales and marketing perspective. But also, I think that that's mirrored on the buyer side by a change in what people want to buy and how people want to buy.
Yeah. Well, what are you doing for Halloween?
As little as possible. Halloween's on a Sunday this year.
And you gonna wear a costume?
Probably not. not unless really? Grumpy Old Man is a costume. Because I can wear that one. But I mean, here's the thing: is Halloween? Is it going to be Sunday or is it going to be the Saturday before? I hope it's the Saturday before because I'm going out that night and I won't be home. So
yeah. Well, for adults, it'll be Saturday. For kids, it'll be Sunday. And the kids are going to get screwed this year because Halloween was for adults on Saturday.
Right. And they ate all the Reese's.
Yeah. I'm going as Bob from Bob's Burgers.
Really?
Yeah. All right, man. Well, it was good.
What about your kids?
Well, I tried to get everybody on board with the Bob's Burgers plan. So, you know, I wanted my daughter to go as Louise and my son to go as Gene. They were not into it because my daughter is very angsty and wants to get, she's just like, what can I wear where I have a knife or a bat? Like, really? Come on. You're 10 years old.
Well, you know, that just opens up a whole range of comic book universe, potential characters. So good luck with that.
Thanks. I appreciate it. All right, man. Until next time.